Derek Michelle Levine. Okay.
We are going to be finishing the last part of the first source book. If you didn't bring it today, that's fine. It's up on the screen. And I am going to do the sources a little out of order. I decided from a pedagogical perspective that I will present them slightly differently than I had originally intended. We had discussed last week that being amongst the first of the Judean exiles, almost 20 years before the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, when the entire people, the entire Judean nation, is eventually exiled to the foreign lands of Babylonia, that Daniel faces great challenges with regard to this new status and Jewish identity.
I'm sorry, where are we? This
is in the first source book, at the end of the first source book. Okay? We had studied about Daniel that he is going to face great challenges with regard to his new status and maintaining his Jewish identity in the foreign land. And yet, we had ended off last class that at the end of his sefer, we learn that he earns the privileged title of being an Ish Hamudot, a beloved man, beloved with Hashem, with the Malachim, and among those of his generation, because apparently Daniel, while serving in the Babylonian administration and subsequently in the administration of Media, Madai, and also at the beginning of the Persian government, he became an important representative of the Jewish community, which eventually grew up among the foreign empires. I want to conclude this introductory section with, however, a caveat that being a Jew in exile is a kind of limbo status. And there is a measure of uncertainty and ambiguity, in fact, with regard to one's stature and privilege, both in relationship to Hashem and to one's people. And it's interesting, we had mentioned that at the very beginning of Perek Aleph of Sefer Daniel, we had to decode that, in fact, Daniel and possibly Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his three companions, were from Zera HaMelucha, from Bnei Yehuda, that is, that they were from royal lineage. And that is because, perhaps you notice, there is no genealogy. Daniel ben who? Hananiah, the son of whom? There is no genealogy that is presented. When one goes into exile, there is a measure of losing one's identity, a sense of being swallowed up by the foreign nations among whom you are exiled. And so interestingly, there is a controversy, an interesting debate within, starting from the Talmud and going through medieval times, as to whether, in addition to Daniel being labeled and given the beautiful epithet Ish Hamudot, a man who is beloved, whether we should also give him the title Navi, a prophet. We know that Daniel is, his sefer is in the third part of Tanakh, Torah Nevi'im, but he is in the section called Ktuvim. Ktuvim is a rather interesting term. All it means is something that is written. And aren't all the books of Tanakh written? So it's a very interesting classification of the third section of Tanakh. About Vanel, I'm doing the sources out of order. About Vanel, in fact, in the 15th century, says that Daniel had such lofty visions about the future destiny of the world, the future history of the world. And we are going to see, especially next week, that he's going to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the first king about the Neo-Babylonian Empire, with regard as well to the future of all of world history. Abba Benel says that therefore it must be that he had a hasaga nevuit elyona, that he must have had a very high level of prophetic insight and prophetic inspiration. It wasn't just that he had chalom pashut tivi. It wasn't just a dream, but it is a very, very high level. Madrigat Daniel is so high because of the fact that he reveals about the future kingdoms that are going to rule the world and eventually the future redemption of Am Yisrael and the coming of Mashiach, and as well, Tchiyat HaMetim. But interestingly, there are those commentators who maintain that while Daniel may have had very important, groundbreaking prophecies, which are unprecedented among the Nevi'im, still in all Daniel's prophecies, his visions are very different. Now, he could still be classified as a Navi because he is still living in the time when prophecy existed among Am Yisrael. There are many prophets who prophesied after Daniel as Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And yet, while Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, their nevuot are in the section called Nevi'im, and they are called very clearly with the title Navi, we never see that Daniel is actually characterized as a Navi. And what's interesting is we see that his nevuot are very unusual. Because in source 27, in the last chapter of Sefer Daniel, we learn that he is commanded, V'atad Daniel, stom ha-dvarim, v'chatom ha-sefer ad eight kates. Keep these words secret. Seal them up until the time of the end, until the time of the Geulah. Only then, when the Geulah arrives, when the Kates arrives, Yishotetu Rabim v'tirbe hada'at. Only then will we have the increase of knowledge, and we will be able to go back and truly understand all the secrets and all the cryptic information that is presented to Daniel in his visions. Daniel is told, Lech Daniel, go. Kistumim v'chatumim ha-devarim ad et kates. The words of your prophecies are not meant to be understood. They're meant to be incomprehensible until eight kates. At that time, yitbareru v'yitlabenu v'yitzarfu rabim, v'hershiu reshaim v'lo yavinu kol reshaim v'maskilim yavinu. At that time, there's going to be a purification process, a purging, and the wicked who acted will then finally, they will not understand, but they will be removed from our midst, and only then will knowledge now prevail. So, from this perspective, Daniel may be technically a Navi, but he doesn't have that title. And interestingly, the Rambam in Source 29 in Moreh Nevuchim and the Guide for the Perplexed, which is explained by the Radak in Source 30, Rav David Kimchi, he maintains that, in fact, Daniel is relegated to the section of Ketuvim purposely, because his level of prophecy, his level of communication from the divine realm is different than that of other Nevi'im. And therefore, as Radak says in Source 30, even though Daniel had amazing visions, still in all, lo higia kocho v'yidiyato ba'otan ha-ma'ot kekoach Yishayahu v'yecheskel u'she'ar ha-Nevi'im. The power of his, the prophetic communication, is not on that level as in the case of other Nevi'im. The Ramban, in fact, tells us that because Daniel communicated primarily through a malach, through angelic intermediaries, and not directly from Hashem, that also indicates a distancing because of the fact that Daniel is in Galut. And in fact, very interestingly, and I know I'm doing these sources out of order, but I wanted to end off with this point. Very interestingly, the Zohar tells us, Nivu'ah, Lo Shraya in Source 28, Ela Ba'ara Kadisha. Full-fledged Nivu'ah does not happen except in Eretz Yisrael. And Daniel is in Chutz La'aretz. Daniel is in Galut. Of course, you could ask the question about Yechezkel, because many of his nevuot are in Chutz La'aretz, and actually that is debated by Chazal in Masechet Moed Katan. But I want to also end off with a very interesting point. This whole controversy begins in the Gemara in Masechet Megillah in Source 26. And while we won't get into the details of this Gemara, what's very important is that this Gemara contrasts Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi with Daniel. And they say very importantly, they are superior to him because they are prophets and he was not a prophet. This is very strong language in the Gemara. The Gemara says very importantly, Inhu Nevi'i ve'ihu lav Navi. He is not a Navi. You can see how Abarbanel, with whom I started, that's why I decided to start the sources differently, Abarbanel is very insistent. Of course Daniel is a Navi. He had the most unbelievable visions that are so relevant to our contemporary times. And yet the Gemara in Masechet Megillah said he is not a Navi. How is that possible? Very importantly, Rashi on this particular Gemara says the following. Why are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi called Nevi'im? And Daniel does not acquire that title. Shenitnabe'u li'Yisrael b'shlichuto shel makom. Vehu lo nishtaleach li'Yisrael b'shum nevu'ah. A Navi is not just an individual who receives prophetic visions and communications from Hashem or through angelic intermediaries. A Navi, says Rashi, based on this Gemara, is an individual who is a shaliach to Am Yisrael. It's one who communicates these prophetic messages to Am Yisrael. It's one who has that direct rapport with his people, rebuking them, chastising them, disciplining them, sometimes patting them on the shoulder when they do something right. But Daniel is not that kind of individual. Daniel is an administrator in the Babylonian palace. And as a result, we have to start thinking about what is his role? Indeed, how is he going to function in this particular capacity to be a role model Galut Jew, to represent Am Yisrael, especially when the Jews are eventually exiled as a result of Chorban Bayit, when a Babylonian community does grow up, he doesn't live among them. He lives near the palace, and he is administrating and functioning with the kings of these different empires. How is Daniel then going to serve for us as the role model Galut Jew? So with this, I would like to move on to our next booklet. Okay, you want to help me? Yep. To part two.
Yep.
And now we will go in order. Does everyone have the second booklet? You're with me? Part two? Just want to make sure everyone's okay. Yes? I gave out a bunch on the table. Okay. Let's remember that Nebuchadnezzar has a plan for these Babylonian captives. I should say these Judean captives who have been brought to his palace. Daniel is taking the elite, the creme de la creme. Among them, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Nebuchadnezzar is taking the creme de la creme, the elite, and he's going to put them in school for 3 years. Remember, he's going to acculturate them to Babylonian culture. They were hand-picked. These were individuals who had a beautiful appearance, had tremendous capacities intellectually and talents and aptitude to be able to learn Babylonian language, the Chaldean language, as well as Babylonian culture and literature, and to have also the strength and the fortitude to stand for long periods of time to serve the king. You recall that the text had told us at the beginning of Perek Aleph that in addition, Nebuchadnezzar commands his chief officer to rename these four individuals. They are given names that are now representative of pagan gods. Belteshazzar is Daniel. By the way, do not confuse Belteshazzar with a tet, with the last king of Babylonia, whose name is Belshazzar. A little confusing, but be careful. We have Hananiah is Shadrach, Mishael is Meshach, and Azariah is Avednego. Okay, all named after different Babylonian gods. The verb that was used when the chief officer was commanded to do so, and he fulfills Nebuchadnezzar's command, was the verb vayasem, that he put into place this decree, he implemented it by changing their names. What is Daniel's reaction to all of this? In relation as well, where we had ended off, that the king is going to control their diet. He not only wants to control their minds, he wants to control everything about them, even their bodies. And the king had insisted that they are going to eat a certain regimen, although the Malbim had said, since the text wrote Dvar Yom B'Yomo, that maybe the menu changed every day, but it's still going to come from the royal kitchens. What is Daniel's reaction to all of this? He can't do anything about the fact that his name's been changed. Whatever they call him, they call him. But the question is, what can he do otherwise to prove that he is not going to easily succumb to the forces of the foreign attempts to assimilate him and to subdue his national Jewish identity? Vayasem Daniel alibo. Notice the verb vayasem. It carries over. What does Daniel put his mind to do? Asher lo yitga'al. Befad bag hamelech uviyein mishtav. Vayivakesh misar asarisim asher lo yitga'al. The English translates it, Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the king's food or the wine he drank. So he sought permission of the chief officer not to defile himself. This verb yitga'al, the shoresh gimel aleph lamed, which I'm sure many of you think about when you see that verb, it reminds you of ge'ulah, ironically. This verb is a very unusual verb. And we need to analyze what is on Daniel's mind, alibo, what is he setting his mind to do? By refusing the menu and the royal diet of the king. Let's just read through the story so that you have the entire picture. Va'itein ha'elokim et Daniel lechesed ulerachamim lifnei sar asarisim. Hashem disposed the chief officer to be kind and compassionate toward Daniel. Certainly, some of this language should remind you of Yosef when he is in exile, of Esther before Ahasuerus. There are very interesting parallels between these three personae, Daniel, Yosef, and Esther. Vayomer sar asarisim leDaniel, yarei ani et Adoni ha-melech. Asher mina at ma'alchalchem ve'et mishtechem. I am very afraid, says this chief officer, of the king, because he appointed me to make sure that you have a certain diet. Lama yir'eh p'nechem zo'afim mi'en ha'yeladim asher kikilchem v'chiyavtem et roshi la'melech. Notice the chief officer is really not concerned about the type of diet. He's concerned about the end results. If you don't take this diet, then you are going to look pale and pallid. And interestingly, the English translates, you're going to look out of sorts compared to the children who are your age. And then it will be off with my head. I am putting my life in jeopardy with the king. Now notice the question becomes, what is this patbag? Patbag is not a Hebrew word. It's a Persian loan word, patibaga. And patbag just really means, generically, honorific food. The food that comes from the royal table. Specifically, what is this diet is not specified in the word itself, or the two words, they've been separated, of patbag. Rashi very clearly says, pat here does not mean bread. but rather this is a Persian word. We can see it right in source number 3. Rashi says there are those who think that patbag means lechem. That's not true. Ein nir ekein, but rather it is a word that has to do with cooked foods in Babylonian. In the language of the Babylonians among the Chaldeans, really it's also a Persian loan word. Now, what happens? Daniel says to the lower waiter, whom the chief officer appoints over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Daniel says to the waiter, Nasna davadecha yemim asara. Let's have a test. Once Daniel sees that the chief officer, first of all, is pointing off the responsibility to his lowly waiter, and he notices that the chief officer doesn't really care what kind of food they eat, as long as they look good at the end of the day, Daniel says, test us for 10 days. Give us seeds or lentils and water for 10 days. ויראו לפניך מראינו ומראה הילדים האוכלים את פתבג המלך וכאשר תראה עשה עם עבדיך. Compare our appearance with those who are eating from this royal honorific food from the patbag. And then if you see things aren't going to work out, he leaves it very open-ended. Do as you see fit. So they agreed to this plan. And 10 days they are tested. And what happens in Pasuk Tedvav? Umikzat yamim asara nir'a mar'ehem tov uvri'ei basar mikol ha'yeladim ha'ochelim et patbag ha'melech. They actually looked even better and healthier than all the other youths who were eating of the king's food. So, very interestingly, the Meltzar actually gets a lot of benefit, because the Meltzar, when he brings them the honorific food from the royal table and the wine, he takes it for himself and he says, here, you can have your zer onim, you can have your lentils. Why is Daniel risking his life, as if, sounds like the chief officer feels he is risking his life, when it comes to the issue of not wanting to eat what the royal diet is prescribing? We would perhaps assume the issue is kashrut. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, it doesn't say specifically he's going to be given pork, but even if he's given meat that is from other animals, most probably it is not prepared properly. But what about the wine? The wine is an interesting question, because at this point in time, there is no decree necessarily not to drink of Gentile wine. But let's also first keep in mind about the meaning of the verb ga'al. In other contexts, as I show you in source number 2, this verb is used for a sense of revulsion and defilement, but in various interesting contexts. For example, in Yeshayahu, we have the phrase, ki chatechem nego'alu badam. Those who are murderers are being described as having their hands defiled with blood. Notice the verb, nego'alu, the shoresh gimel aleph lamed. In Malachi, he talks about those who are bringing to the altar lechem migo'al. Lechem, bread that is not fit to be sacrificed on the altar. In the book of Ezra, when Ezra has a problem about the Kohanim who want to now serve in the second Beit HaMikdash, because their genealogies have been corrupted because many of their families had intermarried, in order to prove that they are fit to serve in the Beit HaMikdash, they had to present their genealogical records. But many of them did not have their genealogical records. They were lost. And so Ezra decided, Vayigo'alu min ha-ki'una. that they are going to be ousted and excluded and deemed unfit for priesthood. So that the verb ga'al in many different scenarios is referring to a situation where something is defiled, unfit, excluded. So Daniel decides that the food coming from the king, as well as the wine, is defiled. It is unfit. He is excluding it from his diet. Instead, he is going to eat commoner's food, lentils, beans, and water. Our commentators wonder, why is it that Daniel is making such a fuss about this? Why would he perhaps want to do a Kiddush Hashem, risking perhaps his own life for martyrdom? Because if he is found out, that could be a very strong possibility when it comes to the issue of kashrut. Is kashrut a particular command where you have to risk your life to die and not transgress this particular mitzvah?
No.
So there are those commentators like the Ibn Ezra who maintain in sources 4 and 5 that in actuality the patbag is cooked meat. But very interestingly, he also maintains that the wine was forbidden because this is wine that is yayin nesech, i.e. wine that was used in sacrificial wine libations to the pagan gods. And the implication of Ibn Ezra as well, and Malbim also follows that derech, is that this meat was actually sacrificed to the pagan gods, and that's why it's on the royal table. This is an assumption made by some of our commentators that indeed we are not just dealing with Daniel risking his life to avoid non-kosher food, which Mitzudat David very clearly says it's non-kosher food, but it's food shel akum. It's food that was used for idolatry. In which case, we could say that here he does not want to transgress one of the three cardinal sins for which one should sacrifice one's life and not transgress that prohibition, the prohibition of idolatry. Nevertheless, there are commentators who take into consideration that Daniel's motivation, framed with the qualification Asher lo yitga'al, using that verb, gimel aleph lamed, might have wider ramifications and implications. Because it is not wholly apparent from the pshat of the text itself, at least with regard to the wine, that it had been used absolutely as wine libation sacrificed to the pagan gods in the context of this royal diet that is being prescribed for Daniel. In which case, the commentary of Rav Shmuel Masnut, which is called Midrash Daniel, it's not a Midrash, that's how he called his commentary. He's a 13th century Syrian commentator. He says, we should also take into consideration that the verb Gimel Aleph Lamed has correlations to another parallel verb, Gimel Ayin Lamed. The Aleph and the Ayin often interchange. Gimel Ayin Lamed means defilement. And therefore he says what? Anu chayavim liyot be'enenu in source 6, kol ma'achal tov ve'arev, v'shamein shel goyim, v'chol yein mishtehem, shu tov ta'am v'reach ki'ilu. He doesn't even necessarily talk about the issue of kashrut here. But every food that the guy offers you and is forcing you especially to eat, even if there's this really good food, the delicacies of the royal table, you should look upon it as something disgusting, as something that is defiled, as something that you do not want to consume in your body, and make this Gentile food a part of yours, even if technically we could find ways to say it's not totally not kosher. What's interesting is we need to think about this pasuk in Yechezkel. In chapter 4, Hashem says to Yechezkel when he is exiled, you should know, Kacha yochlu b'nei Yisrael et lachmam tamei bagoyim asher adichem sham. You should know that even your bread, literally bread, or your food generically, when you eat in galut, everything is tameh. Why is it tameh? Because of the fact, and interesting, Rashi says, tameh here is lishon ma'us, an expression of repugnance, because you're no longer in Eretz Yisrael. You're living among the goyim. Just by that very fact, your food is tameh. Why is that? The Ralbag explains to us in source number 7. The Ralbag explains because if we eat with the food of the goyim, of the Gentiles, and we drink their wine, what's going to happen? Yihyeh diba shetarbeh ha'ahava beinam v'ulay yitchatenu ze bazeh. We're going to assimilate. We're going to become closer to them. Food is a great social binder. We're going to join them with their wine and their food, and then we'll start talking to them, and all of that is going to snowball to intermarriage. And if we intermarry, we're going to eventually worship their idolatry. So much so that, interestingly, do it this way. No. Let's try again. No. So much so that in Masechet Avodah Zarah, we learn that actually the text said, Vayasem Daniel alibo asher lo yitga'al b'fat bag hamelech uviyein mishtav. Mishtav is plural. What's the second liquid that Daniel decided he does not want to partake of among the Gentiles? Wine and oil, shemen. Now there is a machloket among the Amoraim. If Daniel decided to make this chumrah on himself, just for himself, or also for all of the Jews, all the Jews who are exiled as well. But the explanation that is given is, why is Daniel especially being so machmir on yayin stam yenam, even if it was not given, for wine libations, which by the way was only codified and formalized as a decree that any wine of the Gentiles, not just wine that's given in sacrificial offerings, is forbidden to us. That was only formalized later on in the time of Bayit Sheni. But this Gemara is actually saying that it is Daniel who initiated this decree, and while it might not have been one that was promulgated among everyone, that he is the originator of this decree. He went so far as also to decree against Gentile oil, shemen. This was not necessarily accepted later on because it became too onerous for the Jews to maintain that particular prohibition. But why is it that he decided to be so makpid, so strict upon himself? The Amora says, Mishum avodah zarah gazru bahen. And as Rav Aydin Steinsaltz explains, bread of the Gentiles, oil, wine, daughters, they're all decreed upon due to the concern that the Jews might participate in idol worship with Gentiles as a result of intermingling with them. So, the general term, asher lo yitga'al, perhaps is referring to the fact that Daniel has many motivations in mind. Not giving in to eating of the royal diet, not only from a technical kashrut perspective, which has its questions, Perhaps it was used for sacrificial offerings to the pagan gods. So is there a possibility of transgressing an aspect of the prohibition of idolatry? But perhaps even more so. Daniel does not want to assimilate. He doesn't want to join these Gentiles. And he is going to make a stand that he is not going to enjoy their foods. He's not going to defile himself among them in that way. But maybe there's yet another motivation that we can think about. While it is true that Daniel is not being asked to sit at the king's table, per se, it's very interesting that in other contexts, where we talk about individuals who eat from royal food at the royal table, the implication is what? That they are showing political obeisance to the conquering king. They're showing a political subjugation to the powers of these foreign rulers. So, for example, Jehoiachin at the end of Malachim Bed, at the beginning of Source 8, would always eat at the table of the Babylonian king. Remember, he was the second to last king of the Judean monarchy. It was Jehoiakim, during whose time Daniel was exiled, then Jehoiachin, and then the last king was Tzidkiyahu. We have, interestingly, after the entire lineage of Shaul HaMelech is killed out, there is one remaining individual from all of the line of Shaul, and that is Mephibosheth, Shaul's grandson, the son of Jehonatan. David calls Mephibosheth and he says, "You should eat at my table all the time now. Yochal tamid lechem al shulchani." Is it possible that David wants to make sure that Mephibosheth, even though he has physical incapacities, will not try to start up another rival kingship? Eat at my table. Similarly, in Daniel Perek Yud Aleph, which is the only other place in all of Tanakh that the term Patbag is mentioned, it talks about Ochle Patbago Yishberuhu. This is talking about the conflict later on in Sefer Daniel, that in the future there will be a conflict between the kings of the north and the kings of the south. Who are they? We do not know. And the text indicates that Daniel has the vision that those who are eating of his food, pretending to be supporters of this particular king, in the end, there's going to be a coup, and they're going to break him and ruin him. What does it mean to eat at the king's table? It means to support the king from a political perspective. So even though Daniel is not necessarily eating at the king's table, nevertheless, refusing the king's food is a way of showing refusal to accept the political authority and sovereignty of this new king over Daniel, a royal Judean. And therefore, he is going to eat Zer Onim and Mayim, commoner's food. The Midrash Tanchuma tells us, taking advantage of the number 10, the Midrash Tanchuma explains to us, Hashem tested Avraham. And here Daniel says, test us. Our Midrashic rabbis have very keen ears. And they always hear echoes of parallels between different stories, different contexts. And they say, that is deliberate, because you need to make these correlations between them. So says the Midrash very tragically, Bo re'eh ma bein rishonim lachonim. Let's pay attention to the difference between the earlier and later generations. In the rishonim, in the earlier generations, who is testing? Hashem is the one who is testing us. But in the achonim, in the later generations, who is testing us? the nations of the world, umot ha'olam. It's interesting that this Midrash quotes you, that pasuk in Yechezkel that I had mentioned earlier, that when we live among the nations of the world, all of our food is tameh, lachmam tameh. Daniel, when he is exiled, Hashem decreed, yochlu lachmam tameh. Nebuchadnezzar stands up and makes a decree that they have to eat pat bagol, they have to eat from his royal food. Daniel lo kibel alav. Daniel is not accepting this. He says to Hashem, Afa pi shegazar HaKadosh Baruch Hu aleinu shenochal lechem tameh, bikesh lenasot otanu. Really, this is the test. The test is, will we succumb to the enticements and the lure and the entrapments of assimilation? We can associate this with the verb gimel aleph lamed, which means redeemed. Will we act as if we're redeemed, i.e. that we're going to eat from this royal, you know, lush, delicious, delicacies, we're going to eat all these rich foods, that's going to show as if we're redeemed, not enslaved? Or as the Ralbag says, if we assimilate among the Gentiles, we're just going to delay our ge'ulah, our redemption. So Daniel says, I understand, Hashem, you're really testing us. We're going to pass the test. Anu naset shelanu. We're going to do our part, and we're going to show you we passed this test. Hashem tested Abraham, according to Chazal, Pirkei Avot, 10 times. How many days does Daniel say test us for? 10 days. And then Daniel says, v'hu yaset shelo. I hope that Hashem is going to reciprocate and do his part, and Hashem does. Hashem makes them have chesed and rachamim before this waiter, and they look even healthier and better than everybody else. A side point, the Malbim, who lives in the 1800s in Eastern Europe, says this is a very huge miracle because they're only eating lentils and water as opposed to meat and rich foods. So it's amazing, right, that they're so healthy. Interestingly, the earlier commentator, Ibn Ezra, who lived in many countries, but also in Spanish Muslim lands, he says, but they're eating a vegetarian diet. So it's a great miracle that he didn't get caught, that Nebuchadnezzar did not pay attention, did not want to know if he's really eating the royal diet or not. There are great miracles, but something to think about. Okay. In fact, we learn in Masechet Megillah about Esther. A very interesting parallel to Esther. The question becomes, what food did Esther eat when she is trapped in Ahasuerus's palace? According to one opinion, Rav, she ate machal Yehudi. Somehow she got kosher food. But according to Shmuel, she ate kadli de chaziri. She ate pork, even though it was not kosher. Now, in that opinion, the Tosafot gets very upset. Rashi, on the one hand, in that opinion, says, "Mitoch onsa lo ne'ensha." She is in a situation of ones, and therefore you can't punish her for eating non-kosher food. Of course, that highlights even more so how Daniel, even notice this is a quiet rebellion. Nebuchadnezzar does not find out. The Meltzar and the chief officer, they make a deal here under the table. And in the end, everybody looks healthy and good, so no harm done. Nevertheless, Daniel is really going out of his way here, because this opinion says she was in Be'ones, and therefore you cannot punish her. Of course, Tosafot gets very, very upset and says, Chas v'shalom, ilo ayta ochelet. It's impossible. She didn't eat pork. There's no way. I will point out to you that there is a different girsa of this Gemara in the Sefer Ha'aruch of Rabbi Natan ben Yechiel of the 12th century. And he actually says, you should really read Kadli de Chaziri. You should really read it as Chazeret or Kadli de Chizri, i.e. she was given lettuce. That would solve all the problems. But let's look at the third opinion. The third opinion of Rabbi Yochanan is that she ate zer onim. She ate lentils. And he quotes the text from Sefer Daniel that Esther decided to model herself after Daniel. On the other hand, in Source 11, we learn that Nehemiah, living in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, he is a Persian diplomat, a representative of the Persian Empire, during the king whose name is Artaxerxes, Artaxasta. Nehemiah had the job in the royal administration to be Mashkel HaMelech, to be a cupbearer. Our commentators actually say that based on the next text that he is brings l'Artaxasta HaMelech Yayin Lefanav Ve'esat HaYayin Ve'etna LaMelech. Our commentators maintain that in actuality he had to drink Sarich Lishtot Mikodem She'itena Kos B'yad HaMelech She'lo Yachshedu She'natan Bosam. They made Nehemiah drink the wine before he could give it to the king, so that you can make sure the wine was not poisoned. In which case, interestingly enough, the Yerushalmi points out that an individual who is named Hatir Shata at the beginning of Sefer Ezra, that was another name for Nehemiah. Why? Because it's a compound word. Hatir Shata. He was permitted to drink because he was Mashkel HaMelech. So very interestingly here, he does not risk his life, because perhaps he's, even if it's non-kosher wine, because perhaps he thought that this is a better way, right, to be able to serve the Jewish people in the Persian Empire. So it's interesting that one of the commentaries on the Yerushalmi says, apparently, why does it have to say hitir? They gave him permission. Because Nehemiah haya min ha-mekablim gzeirato shel Daniel. Even though Daniel made a chumra about stam yeinam, not just yayin nesech, Nehemiah took upon himself that chumra. And so he had to have hatarat nidarim in order to be able to serve in this capacity with the king. Lehatir lo kedin kol nidarei mitzvah. Of course, if you follow the opinion in the Gemara Masechet Avodah Zarah, that this was only a decree Daniel made upon himself, and he did not promulgate it and spread it to the others, then we would have to say that even more so, right? Nehemiah took it upon himself, and that's why he needs Hatarat Nidarim in order to serve as Mashkel HaMelech. So the scenario as a Jew in exile, in a public capacity, how far you need to go to risk your life, and should you, in fact, perhaps think about ways that you can live and in that capacity better serve the Jewish communities in exile, these are very difficult situations. And a lot of the determination of how we should act in Galut in these very precarious circumstances are in fact learned out from the way that Daniel and other famous Jews in exile conducted themselves. So, I'm just going to start you off with the next section, and we will continue next week with it. In chapter 2 of Sefer Daniel, just summarize it for you a little bit. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, but he seems to forget the dream. And only Daniel succeeds in interpreting the dream eventually. But at first, Nebuchadnezzar gets very upset that his own wise men cannot interpret the dream. And he begins to illogically assassinate his own people, his own advisors. Daniel does not step up here. Here, Daniel does not step up to try to intervene until his own life is threatened, as well as that of his colleagues, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Daniel davens. Hashem grants him the ability to fulfill Nebuchadnezzar's request. He does an amazing Kiddush Hashem before all of the Babylonians, that only Hashem has the answers. But that also puts him at great risk, because now everyone feels that they've been humiliated by a Jew in exile. And that gets even worse, because at the end of this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar promotes Daniel to be the head officer over all the wise men of Babylonia. I want to do it more specifically because I think it's good for you to appreciate some of the dynamics of the plot that is described in Sefer Daniel. So we'll go through it in an overall fashion now for the next few minutes, because I only have about 3-4 minutes left, and then we will discuss this more in detail next class. Bishnat shtayim lemalchut Nebuchadnezzar chalam Nebuchadnezzar chalamot. Vatitpa'em rucho ushnato niyata alav. Again, if you hear the parallels to Yosef and Paro's dreams, and Yosef eventually being the dream interpreter. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. And he was very, very upset. And he couldn't sleep. He commanded to call the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, to tell the king his dreams, and they came and stood before the king. One important note, you are going to see within Sefer Daniel lots of lists. Look at this long list. Chaltumim, Ashafim, Mechashafim, Kazdim. There are going to be many times in Sefer Daniel using the style of what we call the list genre. Interestingly, if you look in parallel texts during the time during which Daniel lived among Babylonian archives, Persian archives, very interestingly, this was a style of the time. Always to write and record very copiously and very, very precisely using lists. Vayomer lahem hamelech, halom chalamti vatipa'em ruchi ladat et achalom. The king said to them, I had a dream, I'm very upset, I need to know the dream. Well, there's a number of questions we need to ask. First of all, what is the timing of this dream? Second of all, what does he mean when he said, I had a dream, but you need to tell me the dream? As far as the timing, we have two possibilities that are raised by our commentators, to which we will return when we have the whole story in mind, because it will become even more relevant. Either it means literally the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So he started in 605 BCE. So this is about 603, 602 BCE, right? Or perhaps, as Ralbag says, maybe it's the end of 2 years, the beginning of the third, right? 2 full years have been completed. It's the beginning of the third. In which case, one needs to ask, why is he having dreams that are so upsetting to him at that particular juncture? In Tanakh, when individuals have dreams, they are very weighty and very momentous and have tremendous ramification and implication. Perhaps we could say, since this is the very beginning of his royal kingship, he's feeling very insecure, very unstable about how things are going to pan out. Will he be able to solidify a world empire? And that is why he's dreaming. On the other hand, Abarbanel says, quoting you the Midrash in Seder Olam Rabbah, that it means the second year after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So if the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed in 586, this is 584 BCE, which is over 20 years later. Over 20 years since Nebuchadnezzar started his rule in 605 BCE. And Abarbanel likes this opinion. V'hu dat yashar. Why? Because of the fact that he says, it says, Bishnat shtayim lemalachut Nebuchadnezzar. when has he finally solidified his reign? He calls it, very interestingly, he calls it a monarca, right? What's called by them a monarca. What's a monarca? A monarchy, right? When do you have a monarchy? When you've completed all of your conquests, especially the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. Now you've got a secure, stable empire. So why is he dreaming? Because he wants to know, how long is my empire going to last? What is the future of my empire? How are things going to develop and play out? And he sees things happening in the Atid, in the future, in this dream. So now, did he forget the dream? Or is he merely testing his wise men? If he is testing them, it's unprecedented. And his wise men are going to emphasize that to him over and over. No one has ever asked us to tell the dream itself with all of its different images, as well as the interpretation. You tell us the dream images, we will tell you the interpretation. Or, did Nebuchadnezzar really forget the dream? And Hashem did that to him on purpose. Of course, you could say, well, when he hears the interpretation, how would he know it's the right one? Well, maybe it would just draw his memory. But maybe Hashem, not that he's testing the wise men, but he really forgot the dream. And that's why he's so panicked. Because something inside of him says, this is really important. I need to know about it. But he's very panicked because he forgot the dream images it themselves, not just looking for interpretation. And maybe Hashem did that on purpose, because the wise men are all going to be stymied, and they're going to be stifled, and they're going to be completely puzzled. We can't do what you want us to do. So interestingly, as the text is going to continue, we're going to learn that they're going to throw up their hands. And they're going to say, we don't have access to the gods to be able to have us be told not only the interpretation, but also first, the dream itself. And Nebuchadnezzar is going to look at them and say, what? You're supposed to be my wise men, your sorcerers, your enchanters, my magicians, your soothsayers. You're supposed to be tapping into the divine realm. What do you mean you have limitations? He gets so upset, he wants to kill everybody out. But where is Daniel in all this? Can't Daniel say, hello, I'm here, I can help you? First of all, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't even know he can do dream interpretation yet, because Daniel has not been asked to do that. Later on, when Nebuchadnezzar has yet another dream in chapter 4, he runs immediately to Daniel. But why hasn't Daniel stepped up to the plate? Because this is Daniel. Why should he get involved when it's not his problem? Let him deal with the wise men, all of his entourage of wise men. When does Daniel get involved? When Nebuchadnezzar wants to kill him and sends the executioner, Alioch, after him. And after Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, oh, now we have a problem. And that's when Daniel says, hold everything. Stop the executions. I need a little time. I'm going to talk to Hashem, and hopefully things will work out. We will continue with this next class.